Okay, this is case number 76417, Jose Valdez-Jimenez versus 8th Judicial District Court. See if you have no party in interest. We have Ms. Lemke on behalf of the petitioners. I see Ms. Craig there as well. Mr. Gerstein, is Mr. Gerstein here?
He's not
here. Okay, I had him on the list. And, of course, Mr. Owens representing the state. Okay, this is on for 60-minute oral argument. Ms. Lemke, would you like to reserve some time?
I'd like to reserve
time. You may do so. Okay, you, the petitioner may proceed. Mm-hmm.
May it please the court, my name is Nancy Lemke. I am a deputy public defender with the Clark County Public Defender's Office. I will be arguing the case on behalf of petitioners this morning. I'm here today before this court, and forgive me, but I need to put my glasses on, because we are asking this court to find that in order to detain an individual pretrial, the lower courts must conduct an adversarial hearing at which the defendant and counsel are present, and at which prosecutors state that they want to detain the individual and that they establish by clear and convincing evidence that there is no less restrictive way of making sure that an individual is not a flight risk or a danger to the community other than detaining pretrial. I want to be clear at the outset and tell the court that we are not asking this court to find cash bail unconstitutional, and we are not asking this court to resolve the issue of petitioner's custody status on the merits. What we are asking for today is a constitutionally sound process that will end Clark County's practice of jailing people who are simply too poor to pay for their release, people like the petitioners before this court. They were detained not because the prosecutors went to court and demonstrated a need for them to be detained pretrial, but simply because they were too poor to pay for their freedom. This violates two critical constitutional guarantees, due process and equal protection. It violates due process, summarily here, because the lower court never made any finding as to each defendant's ability to pay and the need for a detention. Consequently, the proceedings below also violated petitioner's equal protection guarantees because the end result, which was a money bail number rather than a specifically articulated and very transparent detention order, operated as a release, or would have operated as a release condition for a wealthy individual, but for these two poor gentlemen, it operated as nothing more than a detention order. So what we're saying today is that when prosecutors go to court, as they do every day in Clark County, and only ask for a money bail amount without specifying whether or not they're truly seeking detention or some kind of conditioned release, and when a judge does not make a finding as to whether or detention is actually necessary and instead fixes a money bail amount that may or may not be beyond the reach of a defendant, those money bails are unlawful when they result in the detention of individuals who are too poor to secure their freedom. This is what happens in Clark County again every day. Both petitioners here, if you look at the procedural posture of their cases, suffered very similar fates. They were both arrested and both were charged initially down in justice court. They were both booked into the Clark County Detention Center on standard bail. Mr. Valdez-Jimenez had bail set of, I believe, $40,000, and Mr. Fry had a $180,000 bail set. Both were held in custody on those money bail amounts for approximately 4 days before they saw a judge. And at the date of their first appearance, both had counsel appointed, and that was the first time that there was any discussion about whether or not the defendant should be held on the money bail amounts that were set. The prosecutors, as they typically do in Clark County, asked for the money bails to be set at the amounts that they were. And the judges in both justice court cases granted the prosecutor's money bail requests. Both defendants, as a result, because they couldn't post those bonds associated with the money bail amount, remained in custody as their cases moved forward to preliminary hearing.
Ms. Lepke, are you arguing that every time a grand jury indictment is returned, a judge cannot set bail till you have a hearing on it?
Well, it depends. So here's the difference between what happens in justice court, at least now in Las Vegas justice court, versus what happens with a grand jury return. And this case really illustrates what happens with the grand jury return. Again, it's a one-sided kind of ex parte presentation as to the need for money bail and what the implications of that may or may not be. Defendant's not there. Counsel's not there. There's no adversarial process. Prosecutors don't even ask for detention. They simply go in, as they typically do, and ask for money bail. The problem, really, with that grand jury proceeding, aside from that ex parte non-adversarial process that occurs by which the money bail is set, is that then, which brings me kind of to the next part of the story as to what happened to these two gentlemen, it can take weeks before you actually get in front of a judge to decide the issue of custody. So, for example...
Well, what if they're not in custody? What if it's a grand jury return and, you know, the defendant's at large, you know, like that? How should that be handled by the court? I mean, it seemed to me, you know, the chief, I don't know if the chief judge still does it in Clark County, but the chief judge did when I was there. And to me, it was something for the defendant. You know, you don't want a no bail bench warrant coming out of a grand jury indictment. So at least there was some sort of bail that could be set. And then, of course, whoever the department's assigned to could change it at that stage. So
I'm provided that happens almost immediately after there is a bail set. Because otherwise you give rise to an equal protection problem where you have wealthy people who can post the bail right away and get out, and then you have the indigent, such as Mr. Fry and Mr. Valdez-Jimenez, who particularly with grand jury presentments have to sit in custody. Literally, these gentlemen were in custody for a period of about 2 weeks before they could get in front of a district court judge. So unless there is a mechanism by which on a grand jury return you can actually get to court at a time that's commensurate with the time that a wealthy individual can bond out, you have an equal protection problem. And the problem with that ex parte, non-counseled, non-adversarial hearing at the grand jury return is, again, you have a prosecutor not walking into the court and asking for detention, but asking for a money bail amount. With the defendant and defense counsel not there, we don't know if that money bail amount is going to operate as a detention order or a release condition. And as the court is probably now well aware from reading all the briefs on file, money bail was originally, you know, conceived as a mechanism of release, not a mechanism to detain. Over the years, it's morphed into a detention mechanism, but that's not really why it was conceived. So in these grand jury processes, you have these unattainable money bail sets. There's no inquiry by the judge as to a defendant's ability to give bail. And secondarily, there's no inquiry as to whether or not detention is indeed the least restrictive means of assuring that a defendant returns to court and doesn't endanger the community.
To Justice Gibbons' point, defendant's not present at the time of the indictment, generally. They could be in custody in another proceeding, but if they're not present at the time the grand jury gives its true bill and the bail is posted, the bail is set, isn't the real complaint that when they are brought in, they're A, not getting a prompt hearing,
correct,
and then B, not getting a hearing that addresses the factors that you're asking us to address today?
That's exactly correct. And now in Las Vegas Justice Court, you can see a little bit of a contrast, because when an individual is arrested and booked into jail, because we now have our 24-hour arraignment court operating, they are brought to court to deal with the implications of that money bail set relatively quickly. Whereas in the grand jury process, just the opposite happens. So when you have that grand jury return, there is no prompt inquiry about whether or not the money bail setting is appropriate. There is not during the course of that hearing, the appropriate constitutionally required protocols that are adhered to.
So I just had a question, though. If they get picked up on a warrant, because they obviously get Markham notice, but, you know, they don't know when that indictment return is going to be. When they get picked up on the warrant and they're booked in a jail, even in district court, aren't they still brought before the district court judge within the 48 hours or 72 hours to have an initial arraignment and to have perhaps bail looked at again? Or are you telling me that if they're booked on an arrest warrant in district court, somehow it's 4 and 5 days versus what's going on in justice court?
Right. That's a good question, Your Honor. What I can tell you, and I actually did the calculations on that question as to these two individuals, it was almost a week. I think it was like 6 days. For each individual, Mr. Fry and Mr. Valdez-Jimenez, between the time that the indictment warrant or the indictment warrant was initiated and that grand jury return process happened and the time that each defendant appeared for their initial appearance. And keep in mind, too, because the district courts require written motions to address custody, then you can't necessarily address custody at that initial appearance. So number one, that initial appearance time takes much longer from the time of indictment to the time that you come to court. Secondarily, because the district courts require written motions, then you, even if you get your counsel appointed and you file that written motion as quickly as you can, you've still got at least another week to 10 days before that motion can be heard. And that's kind of what happened in Mr. Valdez-Jimenez's case. His trial counsel filed his motion to address custody status, I mean, almost right after he was arraigned in district court. And it still took, I think, 6 or 7 days to get on calendar and be heard. And that does not account for situations where then the motion hearing gets continued. I will tell the court, for example, I argued one of these last week. It had been set 2 weeks prior. We go to court to argue money bail on day one. The responsible prosecutor's not there. The calendar deputy asked for a continuance. It gets continued for a week. We come back a week later, and there was the responsive pleading from the state had not made its way to the district court judge, continued again. So even though you have this motion practice that would, in theory, get you to court within 6 or 7 days, which is not lawful anyway, a lot of times you don't get any resolution on the merits for even longer than that. And we see that happening routinely and obviously in these particular cases.
I'm sorry.
So to clarify your argument, you're maintaining that there is an obligation or a constitutional right for a prompt review of the defendant's custody status following an indictment.
Yes, sir.
And B, there's no statutory construct or timetable or procedure in order to establish that process.
That's not, and that's why it's our position.
And C, therefore, Nevada's statutory scheme on post-indictment bail setting is unconstitutional.
Well, to the extent that there actually is a scheme. Now, I don't know that the Nevada statute specifically addressed time frames and the manner in which once you're in district court, the process by which you determine the issue of custody needs to unfold. But here's what I can tell the court, that if there is a framework that, you know, specifies that it happened in this unconstitutionally extended time, Your Honor's correct, it's unlawful. To the extent that the statutes simply don't speak with any kind of constitutional clarity to that issue, it is incumbent upon this court to set forth those rules so that the procedure that ultimately unfolds is constitutionally sound. So Your Honor is correct. We are asking if the court does not want to find the grand jury return process at which money bail and the issue of detention is adjudicated, if the court does not want to hold that we need to be there and our clients need to be there and that it needs to unfold in the constitutionally appropriate way, then what needs to happen is indeed, as Your Honor pointed out, there must be a prompt inquiry immediately thereafter into a defendant's custody status. And what's interesting, which brings me to the point
so
of like, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What is the constitutional source? Either under the United States Constitution or the Nevada Constitution, to compel the custody review of the defendant by the district court judge post-indictment? And what would be the time frame that would be compelled?
Well, okay, so the constitutional authority derives from the Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses that mandate if you're going to deprive somebody of a fundamental liberty, that there must be an immediate determination as to whether or not that deprivation is constitutionally sound. I can tell the court
so
that...
So implicit in that is the liberty interest of the defendant pre-conviction.
Right. Yes, exactly. And what the courts, you know, as the court knows from the briefing in this particular case, is that a lot of the pre-conviction detention authority derives from that Bearden Tate Williams post-conviction line of authority that talks about liberty deprivations pursuant to the inability of a defendant to pay a money bail amount. And so that has been now found to be the case with respect to pretrial deprivations of liberty, which quite frankly are even a more compelling liberty deprivation because you're talking about somebody who hasn't been convicted yet. Now, what I can tell you with respect to timing is by my review of the authority on this, there are, in a duty of candor to the court, there's basically two cases that I could find that deal with the issue of timing out of the Fifth Circuit and the 11th Circuit. One is Walker, the other one is O'Donnell. And both of those cases went to the circuits from district court opinions where state bail practices such as ours had been challenged, and the district courts have found them to be unlawful for the very reasons that we have articulated in our briefs on this. And one of the things, both district courts found that in order for the process to unfold in the timely manner that's required by the Constitution, that it had to be done within 24 hours of arrest. And on appeal to the Fifth and 11th Circuits, I believe it is, respectively, what those courts did is they said, no, a 48-hour standard suffices. And what they did was they found that 48 standard drawing from what was set forth in the U.S. Supreme Court cases of Gerstein and McLaughlin. And as the court's probably aware, Gerstein is the court, the case that said on Fourth Amendment issues, when you're going to arrest somebody on probable cause, they have to be brought for a prompt determination, a prompt probable cause review by an independent magistrate. And then later the court clarified that prompt means 48 hours. Well, what the Fifth and 11th Circuit did was they imported that 48-hour obligation into this context. Now, you know, 48 hours is better than 6 days, right? I would grant you that. But here's the deal. With Gerstein and McLaughlin, that Fourth Amendment probable cause requirement applied to all defendants. So if there is going to be disparate treatment between individuals who can post their money bond on a scheduled money bond order or something that's set at a probable cause determination or at a grand jury return, and they can get out expeditiously, if a poor defendant has to wait for a hearing, now you have an equal protection issue because now there's disparate treatment as between the wealthy individual who can bond out and the poor individual who has to sit in custody and wait for his hearing. And that those clauses, the due process and equal protection clauses, were not at issue in Gerstein and McLaughlin when they set that 48-hour rule for the probable cause finding. So what I'm telling the court is, while I understand that the 11th and 5th circuits found it, you know, kind of convenient to borrow from that Gerstein-McLaughlin line of cases to decide that 48 hours, much like the probable cause requirement, which applies to all defendants, will suffice on a review of detention, the problem with that analysis is that unless you say, as a court, that that review has to happen within a time commensurate with that which the time that it would take for an individual to bond out on the standardized bail or on the money bail that gets set by the prosecutors, you give rise to an equal protection violation, which was not at issue in Gerstein and McLaughlin. So again, while that authority exists, and I feel compelled to bring it to the court's attention on the 48-hour rule that derives from that 11th and 5th Circuit case, understand that they imported a time frame where there was no disparate treatment between the wealthy and the poor. Our position would be that in terms of the promptness of the inquiry, it has to be at a time that would be commensurate with that which an individual who's bonding out can bond out.
Ms. Lemke, does it matter that in these cases we've got individuals who are already in custody before the grand jury return because of the pre-existing case in justice court, so the fact they're already in custody on, I guess, not the same case number. We know a new case starts with grand jury, but how does that impact the analysis, the fact that they're already in custody? It's not someone that gets arrested and then within however much time we need to have a hearing.
Well, first of all, if you look at what happened in to Mr. Frye and Mr. Valdez-Jimenez, again, the original bail settings were unlawful because, number one, they were first set pursuant to standardized bail. Then when there was a review, not less than 4 days later in each gentleman's case, there was not the constitutionally required procedure employed by the Justice Court. So what happens is that money bail set from which the grand jury returned money bail sets kind of derived, because the prosecutors went in and asked for the same money bail set in the grand jury that had been previously set in the Justice Court. Well, the Justice Court money bail set was unlawful to begin with. The prosecutors, and I know that several members of this court know this because they practiced in district court, prosecutors go to court and they don't ask for detention or release. What they do is they walk in and they ask to have a money bail set. And there is never anybody addressing whether or not that money bail that the state is asking means a de facto order of detention for an indigent or whether it actually operates as a release condition. So what we want is we want prosecutors to walk into court and make a decision, in or out. And if you want them in and you want them detained, you need to say that. And then you need to make that showing that detention is the least restrictive way of assuring what the U.S. Supreme Court has told us are the compelling interests of assuring return to court and community safety. And I see that I'm within my last 10 minutes, if I can reserve the rest for rebuttal.
You may do so. Mr. Owens.
May it please the court, I'm Steve Owens of the Clark County District Attorney's Office here on behalf of the real party and interest state of Nevada in this eminently moot mandamus proceeding wherein both petitioners have pled guilty. They stand to gain no relief from this court. They have no interest anymore in the outcome of this case. They are no longer in pretrial detention. And instead, the counsel of these petitioners have been allowed to remain in the case to seek an advisory ruling from this court based on hypothetical cases for future clients that are not before this court. Time and again, we heard anecdotally discussions in this last argument about this is the way it happens in Clark County. It happens this way, and we all know that it happens this way. No, I don't know that it happens that way, and it didn't happen that way on the record in this case.
Well, it does seem clear, Mr. Owens, from my review of the statutes, that post-indictment there is no scheduled process for reviewing the custody status of the defendant. And moreover, our statutory scheme seems to compel that the defendant be held, and only on his or her showing of good cause may they be released. Those issues are front and square in this case, and certainly are issues that could evade review. Could you address that point?
I disagree. So obviously moot was this case that the federal court didn't hesitate to dismiss mm-hmm. it the minute the defendants pled guilty, which begs the question, why are we here today on this case that's a year old? Why has new life been breathed into it?
Respectfully, because we thought it was worth argument.
I understand there's obviously some on the court that have decided that this is the vehicle on which to fashion some sort of ruling that they feel needs to be said. But the case is moot. There's a constitutional issue here that is a lot of importance and concern to me. It has nothing to do with pretrial detention or bail. It has to do with this court's power and authority to issue advisory rulings on moot cases. They're citing to this Binegar case, which frankly is an embarrassment. It was a mandamus case where in a footnote this court said, this was way back in 1996, was none of the members of this court here, but they said, well, the defendants have pled guilty, mandamus is moot, we can't really issue any kind of relief, but we're going to rule anyway. I mean, any law school student can look at that and say that's an advisory ruling, untethered from any live case and controversy. There's no live case or controversy here. Justice Hardesty, I think you're talking about this capable of repetition yet evading review exception to the mootness doctrine. For some reason, the petitioner's counsel feels that this court treats that exception differently than they do in federal court. Somehow this court's constitutional authority exceeds that of what the federal courts do, and that you can give advisory rulings under this exception. We borrowed that exception in Nevada. We took it from federal law. The exception is the same here in Nevada. It has to be capable of repetition between the parties. And the U.S. Supreme Court said in this very situation, pretrial detention is mooted when the defendant pleads guilty because there's no chance that they're going, or such a slim chance that they would be allowed to withdraw their plea or win an appeal and again be put in the situation of pretrial detention, that's too attenuated. It is not capable of repetition between the parties. And that's what we have here. And so that's the slippery slope that takes us into this discussion of hypothetical cases and anecdotal discussion of what we think is happening in district court. Most of the case law I read here is class action lawsuits where there is a facts and depth of facts where they have all this laid out. There was evidentiary hearings, and you know exactly the procedures that were implemented. We don't have that here. You don't have any of the justice court records, a precious few of them. I put a few of them in district court, and that's why you have on one of these petitioners, you have a couple justice court documents, but you're missing a whole slew of adversarial hearings and discussions on bail that set the stage for the grand jury indictment. Why would there need to be any kind of constitutional readdressing of bail at the grand jury return? It runs from the detention, from the arrest. And my heavens, both these defendants, one had been arrested a month before the grand jury return and the other was 2 months before. All that the judge did in district court at the grand jury return was keep the bail the same as it had been in justice court. And that is exactly what the proponents of bail reform asked the legislature for in their bills that they tried to get enacted. They wanted to make sure that bail stayed the same when we left justice court and went to the district court, because bail is set on charges. Bail was set in this case without any input from the prosecution. I heard all about prosecutors do this, prosecutors ask for this. Bail was set on the charges that they were arrested on. Just because we may have filed a complaint in justice court and later an indictment in district court, that doesn't somehow change the or reset the stage for having this prompt hearing. They had their prompt hearings.
Doesn't our Constitution, both federal and state, and our Nevada statutes require analysis of more than just the charges?
Absolutely, and that happened. And you don't know it because you don't have the justice court record here in front of you. You don't have the financial affidavits. I hear that they're indigent. They claim they're indigent. Where's the financial affidavit? Where's all the records that the justices of the peace had in making a factual decision about these amounts of bail? The bail that we're talking about, $40,000 for Valdez Jimenez and $250,000 for Aaron Fry, those were set in justice court. That's where the adversarial hearing was. That's where they weighed all of these facts. That's where they gave this considered attention. What happened in district court?
The problem I'm struggling with this is I don't feel that I can say with confidence that the constitutional arguments being articulated to us now, to the extent they're constitutional, I don't have enough of a record to the district court to know if these were raised and resolved either before the justice court or the district court. And I don't understand what precisely was argued in justice court, and we don't have the materials here to do that. It's a concern.
It's their obligation to put that in. They're saying they didn't get a prompt hearing within 48 hours. Within 48, Valdez Jimenez was seen by a judge within 24 hours, and bail was set without input from the prosecutor before charges were
filed. Do you have record sites for that?
She's the one that went off the record and started talking about justice court records. So I've seen them. It's not in your record. You do not have those justice court records.
Is a defendant entitled to have their bail reviewed by the district court upon indictment?
Absolutely. Anytime they want to ask for a rehearing on bail, a review of bail, absolutely they're entitled to that.
And isn't it the case that we have in front of us and in the record the transcripts of the bail hearings that were conducted for both of these defendants?
I don't know that those were bail hearings. Those were hearings on motions to vacate detention orders. And the judges found they weren't detention orders. I don't think those were bail motions.
Well, Judge Weiss, in the Fry case, said, I'm going to do what the Justice Court did, essentially. There was no independent assessment, if you look at the transcript, of Fry's detention status. He said, I don't know if I would have set the same bail as the Justice Court did. It appeared as though Judge Weiss thought he was just reviewing on an abuse of discretion standard the amount of bail that had been set in Fry's case. That's what the transcript says.
Well, that's what he was asked to do. It was a motion to vacate illegal detention order. It was not a bail motion like we would normally see and say, we would like another shot to argue bail because here's some new facts, some new circumstances, some new assurances. We'd like another bite at the apple to even repeat what they did at Justice Court. That's what usually happens, and so they get another judge to review it. I don't read these motions to vacate the detention orders as new bail here.
Well, Judge Bayless in the Valdez-Jimenez case said that he reviewed all of the bail factors. Didn't say which ones he reviewed. He just summarily said, I've reviewed them all, and I'm going to stick with this amount.
And what is
that's in the transcript.
And what is wrong with that?
Well,
what constitutional right was violated there?
There's the argument by Valdez-Jimenez is that there was no independent assessment of the amount of bail that was set versus the requirement or the need to address community safety and future appearances, and that Bearden and Salerno make those requirements. I understand the arguments that Salerno is dealing with the federal bail statute, and so that's a separate question. But the request to this court was to review this both on U.S. and constitutional grounds. And we said as far back as 1927 in Ex Parte Maley that bail must not be prohibitory in amount and more than the accused can reasonably be expected to pay. There was no evaluation of the financial condition of the defendant on the record by Judge Bayless,
and certainly none. Absolutely. They asked him to consider it, and he said that he did. And you don't have the financial affidavit in front of you. $40,000 bail set on someone with 23 prior felony convictions is outrageous.
Okay? Is that because you think he should remain in custody the entire time up till trial?
I think he's a terrible risk.
Okay.
All right? And so the judge has to come up with, see if there's sufficient assurances upon which he could be released to the community. And he has shown time and time again that he goes out and commits new crimes. What are we to do? Continue setting bail at amount he can afford, and he goes out and commits another crime, and so now bring him back. Now he has less money, so we reduce the amount of bail?
Sure. No.
We need to let the citizens know that the courts are impotent to protect society from offenders we know will continue to commit offenses while we're trying to take them to trial.
Sure. So I understand those points. So if your conclusion or if the prosecutor's conclusion in this case is this guy needs to remain in custody because he's a danger to the community, isn't that effectively a detention order? Let's just set the bail at an amount that he won't be able to make and we know will be in custody and won't present a danger because we know about this record.
And if that had happened, then maybe we would have something to talk about. But that's not what factually happened here.
What did happen that's not what I just said?
Well, you have a judge that said, I want to make sure that you never get out, and so I'm going to set the bail so high to ensure that you can't get out?
Right.
That's not what happened. We had a judge that looked not just at the financial ability of the defendant to pay, but looked at the danger to the community, their criminal record, their failure to appear in court previously, their lack of ties to the community, to settle on an amount of $40,000 for Valdez-Jimenez.
Right.
Which is, neither one of these defendants had standard bail, by the way. Both of them had individualized considerations, an amount set in something other than standard bail, which can only be looked at as it was a reflection of the judge's individualized consideration of facts that you don't even have before you. I don't know how you can sit in judgment of judges that had facts that you don't have. The district court judges had the Justice Court record to look at, had those financial affidavits, had the risk assessment. We have it, I think, in one of these petitioners, but not in the other. You're missing the risk assessment that they relied upon. It's a woefully inadequate factual record here. And we don't even have the right judges in front of us. This should be a question for the justices of the peace. And incidentally, there's been a lot of bail reform. It's been moving along. We have this initial appearance court. Defendants are being seen by a judge face-to-face within 12 hours. I think we have greatly exceeded what the Constitution requires. And so whatever was going on a year ago in these cases is not even the factual scenario and procedures in effect now.
How do we know that on this record?
I'm sorry?
How do we know that on this record? You're both arguing anecdotally what you know to be true currently or in the past in Clark County. My frustration is I can't go look up the record that says they're getting heard within 12 hours.
And I don't have a burden to bring any record to you. The petitioners do. If they want you to ask, they're asking for relief.
Extraordinary relief.
They need to give you the record to make that happen. All right? I think you can take judicial notice of the of some of this bail reform because the court's been involved in it through various committees, the risk assessment form, the initial appearance court. Those are matters of public record that the way we're doing things today are not the same as how they even happen in these cases. So I just don't think these are the right cases, and they're encouraging the court to latch on to these so you can make some sort of statement about a problem that may or may not exist, but it's not shown on the record in these cases here.
Mr. Owens?
Yes?
If the defendant comes in from just an indictment, so they haven't been previously incarcerated and they get picked up on the indictment, is there any mechanism for them to get promptly in front of a district judge? Just curious.
I don't know, and that's not our facts on this case. We'll have to await for that case and see how it is handled in district court.
Here, how long did it take them from the indictment to get in front of a district judge? What's been alleged, 4 days, week?
I think they, frankly, they can ask, I don't know when they first appeared in district court, but they can ask orally at any time to have bail reviewed. And I think at least in one of these cases, they said, we want to address bail, but we want to wait, we want to put it in writing. Some judges might require it to be in writing. But again, we're talking about hypothetically, anecdotally, how it might happen in other cases. There's nothing to stop either one of these petitioners from filing a bail motion at any time that they appear in front of the district court judge and asking for bail to be reconsidered. But it's constitutionally already, the protection's already been afforded in justice court in these cases. Bring a case where they're indicted after arrest and they're detained, and does the district court judge give them a prompt adversarial hearing? Well, then that would be the proper time and place to address that issue, but factually that's not what we have here.
Once there's the grand jury return, isn't the district court case a different case than the one was in justice court? Doesn't the justice court case get dismissed?
It does, but there's only so many charges. Nowadays, I think they're dismissing it. The district court judges have authority to dismiss the justice court cases, but it used to be that there was a week or two overlap. You mean we get double bail because we have two different charging documents? We get bail in both cases, so we can double his bail for a couple of weeks because we happen to have two charging documents on file? Bail goes to the charges that he's arrested on, and his detention has never changed. They were arrested, and they remained in custody throughout. And so, yes, grand jury initiates a new case, but the charges and his detention on them have been continuous and is singular. And he had bail set on that, and it was continued for ex parte purposes at the grand jury return. The defense attorney usually isn't there. It wouldn't be proper for us now to go ask for more bail. I think we may have done that on occasion. That's why they go to the legislature. It didn't happen here. That's why they've gone to the legislature and asked to keep bail the same. They don't want that bail hearing right then and there because they're not present there. It has to be set at a different time, and they have a right to have that heard anytime they want.
Mr. Owens, can we just go over the procedure again? Because this case involves a grand jury indictment. He was in custody, so we'll stick with those facts here. So when the indictment was returned, as Justice Kagan, it preempts the justice court proceeding as a new district court case number. You present it, your deputy presents it to a judge, the chief judge, whoever it is, on the grand jury returns. The judge accepts it. The judge sets bail, basically, at the recommendation of the district attorney, I assume usually how it's done. And then it's assigned a new case number, a new district judge at that point in time. It's tracked into a district court. So then what's the time period, like in this case, from the date of the return until it went to whoever the new district judge was assigned the case based upon the transfer of the proceedings to district court?
You know, I don't have those dates right handy in front of me. It's going to take me a little bit of looking.
Okay, well, I don't want you to chew up your time here looking, but
it have to also be the time of rebooking in the district court by the jail. That would trigger it, the rebooking of the defendant on that warrant would trigger
Valdez Jimenez was, I believe, his grand jury return was on May 24th. I believe his appearance in district court was on May 31st.
So about a week, then, is what you're saying. Well, that's what we're trying to figure out. I think Ms. Lemke's point, or one of them, is that there's some sort of unreasonable delay here after this grand jury indictment return because the defendant's not present, the counsel's not present. It's just the DA with the judge setting the bail.
And the bail was kept the same as what it was in
court. I get it.
For that very reason that they weren't there.
So it was 1 week in this particular case when he was back in court, and, of course, he could ask to have the bail modified at that time when he gets back.
And he'd already had it modified, an adversarial hearing, several of which the court's not privy to. You don't have the record of that, but several times in justice court that happened. And the Constitution talks about it happening within the arrest, within 48 hours or promptly upon arrest.
So your point in this case, it's a reasonable time. He was back in a week. What's wrong with that? Is that your basic argument?
The Constitution says anything about a prompt bail hearing upon a grand jury return where the defendant's custody has not changed.
This is a new arrest warrant. He's being arrested on a new case on a new warrant, so it restarts the whole process again. He is now being booked on an arrest warrant out of the grand jury on a true bail. Could be different charges, whatever. It starts that clock again, and that's what they're talking about.
Well, I don't see that issue has been briefed. If there's case law out there that treats the grand jury for constitutional purposes as a rearrest that restarts the time where we have to
No, it's again an arrest. Afford... It's just an arrest. It's a brand new arrest.
He didn't leave the jail.
But he's being booked on a new warrant. It's a new sure. arrest.
Sure.
It's a new arrest, which restarts his constitutional rights.
I haven't seen any cases in any of the law of the many briefs, including the amicus briefs, that address that scenario. If there's law out there that says that, it's simply not before the court. I understand the argument, but I don't see any of the law in this area talking about a new case of grand jury return where the defendant's custody has not changed and he's already received a prompt bail hearing.
Mr. Owens, what consideration should the court in reviewing bail or setting bail give to the defendant's ability to pay? The individualized defendant's ability to pay.
It's a factor. It's a factor. It's not dispositive. Mm-hmm. Even in Salerno, the court said we have a long line of cases where the public's right to safety will trump that of the defendant's right to liberty in the pretrial detentions. I couldn't have asked for two better cases to emphasize to the court the risk and danger to the public. If ever there was grounds to have that criteria supersede his ability to pay, these are the cases. This is at the danger to the public is at its highest. And for a regulatory provision, Salerno talked about this in regulatory terms. So long as the defendant's financial condition is considered and is a factor which the judges did consider, there is no constitutional right to have bail set in an amount you can afford. Where does that right come from? I hear them spout that off like this is an understood right to always have bail set in an amount you can afford. It's not in the Constitution. You'd have to make it up and put it into substantive due process, and that's what they're asking the court to do.
Isn't that what ex parte Malley held in 1927 by this court?
You know, I went back and looked at some of those old cases, and I don't know that we can rely. They were not well-reasoned. They were very short, and there was a few sentences here or there that I thought, well, we ought to emphasize that, but then it would say something else elsewhere in the opinion. I don't think those are real reliable. The state of the law across the country is under Eighth Amendment, okay, excessive bail. If you want to talk about the amount of bail, and that's really what they're talking about here, bail that they can afford, that falls under the Eighth Amendment, excessive bail. And courts across the country uniformly say excessive bail does not mean bail that you can necessarily afford because that interest, that limited liberty interest pretrial, is conditional upon your ability to present sufficient assurances that you'll be a good risk to society. That is subordinate to the public's greater interest in protecting society.
So if one of these defendants had the same awful record, right, the same record of ORs, prior cases, etc., but was wealthier, they would have been able to post this amount of bail and been out of custody.
I disagree.
What do you mean?
I think that's a fallacy that is in their brief, that you're talking about an equal protection argument. Show me the similarly situated defendant who was treated differently because of his wealth or poverty.
Well, if someone was wealthier, they would have more ability to post the amount of bail that was set.
You're assuming that bail would be set the same for an indigent person and a wealthy person, and it would be not, because their financial ability to pay is taken into account. You can have bail set in an unaffordable amount for a wealthy person the same as you can have for an indigent person. I don't see an equal protection clause argument here. There is no discriminatory purpose. There is a disparate impact because some people live their lives in a way that they can give assurances that they will be a good risk if they're released to society and that they will return to court. And other people do not live their life that way, and they represent a very poor risk. Aaron Fry, we're talking about indigent people here supposedly. Aaron Fry said that he had a condo in L.A., a car worth $70,000. He had family and friends that could come up with $75,000 bail. I don't know that I would be able to afford a $75,000 bail right now. My finances are stretched, and I certainly don't have a $70,000 car.
So let's talk about Mr. Fry's case. He had a bail set at $250,000. He requested that bail be reduced to $75,000, an amount that he represented to the court he could pay. That's in this transcript.
That is.
And the judge, in reviewing this transcript, says, the district court judge says, here's what you need to understand. The only thing that's before me today is whether or not the $250,000 bail that was set by a different judge was wrong, okay? I can't find that it was wrong. Would I have imposed the same amount of bail? I don't know. And he says, in response to a request by the defendant to address this issue, he basically says, the judge does, that all he's doing is looking at this from an abuse of discretion standpoint. That's not his role in this context. His role is to apply the factors. He didn't do that.
He wasn't asked to.
He was asked to change the bail amount from $250,000 to $75,000. That's on page 3 of the transcript.
He was asked to vacate what the defense was construing as an illegal detention order, which we don't have in Nevada. Constitutionally, we can't hold people without bail. And they're saying that bail in an amount that you cannot afford is tantamount to a detention order.
But, Mr. Owens, isn't the issue that they're raising in this case, and I get your point about mootness, but isn't the issue that they're raising in this case that an amount of bail that is set beyond the means of the defendant is tantamount to a detention order? That's precisely why I keep harping on Malley, because that's exactly what Malley says. And that's the issue that's presented in this case.
It's only tantamount to an illegal detention order if you are solely fixated on the amount of pay, and that is only one of many factors the court has to consider.
But what I'm getting at is, in this case, the judge does not appear to have made any independent assessment of Fry's ability to pay or not pay, nor did he, frankly, appear to look at any of the other factors in simply retaining the $250,000 bond. There's another part of Malley, too, that says that it is necessary to connect the amount of the bail to the reason you're holding him. That is, that it is that he poses a threat to society or he won't appear. And so the amount of bail is set to assure that those things are protected. That's the state's interest. That wasn't evaluated in Fry's case either.
It absolutely was.
Where? Where in the transcript? I'm asking about this judge. I'm asking about this judge. When presented with this motion, was the judge obligated in this case, in Fry's case, to make the same independent assessment of the factors that are contained in our bail scheme?
Well, I think we see differently what the judge in Frye was asked to do. The judge in Frye perceived his role and that motion, which was to sit in review of what a prior judge had done and the bail setting that a prior judge had done, not to re-evaluate bail anew. I don't see their motion as asking them, we want a new bail hearing where this judge takes all those factors into consideration. I don't think he saw his role under that particular motion to be asking that. But the question is, where in the record does it say that he didn't do those things? There's a presumption that judges follow the law. And just because he doesn't spell it out as much, do we really need it? Because any law student can look at this record and see he's got 10 prior felonies for crimes of violence, and this was a bank robbery, armed bank robbery, 5 counts of armed robbery. The danger to the public is extraordinarily high. Very few ties, if any, to Nevada. He came from California. So it's these other factors. It's only detention order if the court looks solely at the ability to pay and sets it in an amount that he can't afford for the express purpose of making sure he never gets out. But when you balance the other factors and say, look at the high risk that he is, if we were to release him to the community, what assurance can we have that he won't reoffend and it'll come back here to court? That factors into the amount, not just the amount he can pay, but these other risk
factors. Was there ever the transcript of the hearing, and I'm repeating myself, but and Frye, the lawyer for the state argues the nature of the crime, and additionally, the defendant has absconded in the past. In 2013, defendant was convicted of taking a vehicle. He absconded to Nevada. He was arrested 2 years later on a fugitive warrant. Over the past 17 years, he's accrued 10 prior felonies. And it goes on and on. The state is making those arguments. The defendant is arguing from 250 to 75. And the court doesn't process it through those factors, but they're certainly presented to the court on defendant's motion to reduce the amount of the bail. They concede that a cash bond of some sort is appropriate. And then the court at the end says this is a violent crime. Was there any order in writing beyond this transcript that says what was or wasn't actually resolved at this hearing?
No.
So this transcript is what we have.
There's nothing in writing that I'm aware of, and I assume you're talking about the petitioner's request that, that there be written findings at all of these bail hearings. I've been down this road.
That wasn't requested here in this case. It's requested in the petition before us, but was it requested in district court? Was there offered findings?
Not in the case below. They didn't ask for written findings, to my knowledge.
Okay. And none were tendered by both sides. Sometimes lawyers will submit them on both sides.
Right. That was not done here.
Okay. So this August 2, 2018 transcript in Frye is what we have.
I believe that's it, yes.
Okay, thank you.
They never make bail. I mean, when have you ever seen a bail order, an actual with findings of anyone's bail in district?
I don't think findings are done. I don't think they are constitutionally required, as I've made that argument many times to this court in other contexts. They're nice to have for appellate purposes. They're helpful. They are not constitutionally required.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Owens.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Mr. Owens, we're at a little bit over a percent to our question, so let's add one additional minute to Ms. Lemke's time here.
So if I kind of hear what Mr. Owens is telling the court correctly, it seems that he kind of wants to re-argue the issue of whether or not the court did the right thing with the bail settings.
Let me pause you there, because I'm very concerned about the record that we have before us. We sit to decide individual cases with live controversies, and generally we review what a district court or a justice court in some writ context did or didn't do that they were asked to do.
Right.
And on this record, I'm concerned about we're being asked to kind of legislate or rule draft rather than decide an individual live case. And so the lawyer in me is concerned about that, that that's a venturesome undertaking in an adjudicative capacity that's not a deck relief and it's coming up on an original writ. Long way around to, we don't have a written order from the district court finding thumbs up, thumbs down, constitutional, unconstitutional, any of the rights that you're asserting here. We have these transcripts. Is that right?
Right. Okay. You mean in terms of what happened at the grand jury return and the motion?
Well, we don't have the Justice Court transcripts. We don't have the financial. I looked for the financial records of the defendants. We don't have any of that. And we don't have any written orders where you tendered the constitutional arguments you're tendering to us, to the district courts or Justice Court, and had us review what they resolved. You're asking us to do this originally.
Right. Okay, so let me first answer the original question, because I think that that's a really interesting one. And what I would tell the court, number one, is quite frankly, the courts routinely are called upon to make rules that are not necessarily reduced to legislative writing. We see that with Batson. We see that with Feretta. We saw it with this court, with Finger, when this court required that defendants in the state of Nevada be entitled to proffer an insanity defense. And in fact, it is not only can you do it, it's really your obligation to do it. And in that regard, I would refer the court to the Fifth Circuit's decision in Giovanni versus Lynn, in which the court said, and I think this is very instructive, quote, where a liberty interest is infringed, the process which is due under the United States Constitution is that measured by the due process clause, not that which is called for by state regulation. So not only is it something that we're asking you to do, but we believe it's incumbent upon you to set forth what the federal constitution requires.
But don't you have to ask for that in the district court first?
Okay, good question. And yes, we did. That's why if you look at the motion to vacate, here's why it was done. And it gets to what Justice Silver asked a few minutes ago about that arrest or that indictment warrant kind of reinitiating the process.
Way the bindover from Justice Court with all those affidavits, financial never goes into district court on an indictment because it's a whole different case file.
Correct. Everything in Justice Court gets dismissed. Now, just so that we're clear, I did actually attach in Mr. Fry's appendix the minutes or the Justice Court printout of the proceeding, so you can see exactly how his case unfolded to confirm the representations that I made here today. I guess Mr. Owens missed that. But more importantly, what Justice Silver said is correct. When you indict a case, it starts anew. It's almost as if, I mean, it is as if the Justice Court's case didn't even exist. So quite frankly, while it's interesting for the court to note just how long these two gentlemen labored in custody, and that's why I brought it to the court's attention as to how long they sat in custody from the time they were arrested and the case went through Justice Court and then ultimately through district court. What's more important is what's at issue here, and if you notice, the issues that we raised derived singularly from that grand jury indictment return and what happened thereafter. So, because that indictment return happened in the absence of the defendant, in the absence of counsel, and in the absence of the constitutionally required procedure, what we did when we went to district court is we filed a motion to vacate. Why? This gets to Justice Hardesty's question about why is the defense always going to court and shouldering the burden to show cause why a defendant should be released? We shouldn't. The Constitution doesn't allow us to do it. If the state wants to detain somebody before trial, they bear the burden of walking into court and articulating exactly why there is no less restrictive way of assuring a defendant's return to court other than and assuring community safety other than detaining them pretrial. And I would refer the court, I think, to Mr. Owens's arguments. Listen to what he told the court, because I'm going to tell you, and I think the court well knows, that these are the kind of arguments that we hear all the time. The guy's really bad. The charge is really serious. He has a history. He has failures to appear. We need, you know, $40,000 money bail in Mr. Valdez-Jimenez's case, or $250,000 in Mr. Fry's case. In Mr. Valdez-Jimenez's case, do you know that if you look at the transcript, the presenting prosecutor there walked in and said, I want this money bail set, and she specifically said, you're not going to hear me ask for an order of detention. So I would ask the court to think about that. What does a $40,000 money bail set mean? Does that mean that she's asking for detention? Because given Mr. Valdez-Jimenez's financial circumstances, it certainly did. And if it does, then they have to jump through the hoops of showing that there's no less restrictive way of assuring community safety and return to court other than detaining him. But what they can't do is walk into court and throw out a money bail amount without regard to whether or not that's going to operate as a release condition or not. And the prosecutors, much like Ms. DeMonte in Mr. Valdez-Jimenez's case, absolutely refuse to make that statement. In fact, the Fry prosecutor did something similar in saying, you know, I don't have to specify whether or not I'm here with my $250,000 money bail request asking for a detention or release. And it's our position that at the grand jury return, that didn't happen. Our position was because it did not happen at the grand jury return, and that was an unlawfully issued money bail or de facto detention order, we have to start the process anew so that I do not walk into court bearing the burden, as Justice Hardesty just so aptly pointed out, to show cause why my client should be released. Again, the due process clause requires that if a detention is going to be had, it must be had on motion of the state. So that what we don't get as a result are these kind of non-transparent de facto detention orders that result when we have these money bail amounts set. Now, without any determinations of indigency and need for detention. Now, I'm not saying that you can't use money bail. Of course you can use money bail. But if it's going to be a detention mechanism, it must be preceded by a request by the prosecutor for detention, and then a showing by the prosecutor that detention is necessary to manage concerns of flight risk and community safety. And if that doesn't happen, or the prosecutor elects not to seek a detention order, then we start talking about release conditions, of which money bail can be one. So again, I can't emphasize it enough. I'm not talking about the merits of the underlying decision. I'm talking about the process by which it was decided. And what I would say to Mr. Owens is, quite frankly, what I've said to many prosecutors arguing this. You heard him stand up and tell you how awful Mr. Fry or Mr. Valdez-Jimenez was. My position is, if you think he's that bad and you want him detained, make your argument. Walk into court and don't have this non-transparent request in the form of a money bail order that they know is going to operate as a detention order for these poor defendants. Tell the court what you're asking for and tell the court why you need it. And when the defendant is there and defense is present to be able to herd on that issue with the state bearing the burden that they need to bear in order to detain, then we have a procedurally proper adversarial hearing at the conclusion of which the judge can detain.
We have evidence in the record about what these defendants' financial ability was, and part two is, how would the prosecuting attorney know what their financial ability is?
Well, and that's why the hearing has to unfold in the manner that we're asking, because that determination has to be done at the hearing, where counsel is there and is present and can be heard on the issue of his financial ability to pay. And that is one of the several procedural deficits that occurred or didn't occur, I guess I should say, in these particular cases. So there wasn't that individualized determination, which is something that dates back all the way to that Williams Tate Bearden line of cases that deal with determinations in the post-conviction setting.
But would it be fair, though, to say that in this particular case, because it's an indictment, there is no bind-over record at all from the
Correct.
Justice Court, so that when, for example, Mr. Owens is saying the Justice Court looked at, that's a different case. The District Court did not have the Justice Court case before it because this is an indictment.
Correct.
There's nothing from Justice Court
Correct.
That they could have ever looked at.
Right. And so whether or not you're doing this constitutionally appropriate procedure that we're asking for, either in Justice Court, if that's, you know, where the case originates, or then in District Court, if ultimately the charging document comes out of District Court, you have to make those individualized determinations as to their financial ability. It's the court's obligation to do that because the court needs to know whether or not it's setting money bail as a condition of release or a de facto detention order. And again, if it is a de facto detention order, that triggers all of those procedural requirements that the Constitution mandates occur before an order of detention pretrial can issue, if that makes sense. I just can't emphasize enough, this is a process argument that we are demanding. And it derives, as Justice Silver pointed out, from that initial grand jury return.
I'd like to hear her comments on mootness, Chief.
Would you address the mootness issue?
Of course. And so with respect to mootness, Mr. Owen said, the federal court dismissed this. Yeah, that's correct. The federal court did. And the reason that the federal court did that is because the federal authority that governs the capable of repetition yet evading review exception to mootness requires that the issue repeat as to the individual litigant that's before the court. This court, and I would suggest very wisely so, does not have such an obligation. This court has a history of hearing matters that are of statewide public importance, which this certainly is, when the challenged action is short, relatively short in time, which certainly we now see by virtue of the fact that both cases resolved before we could get to this argument before your honors. And then there's a likelihood that it will arise in the future, which brings me to another thing that Mr. Owen said. Well, she's made all these anecdotal statements about the record.
Ms. Lamkin, just
one more point, and we're over time, but it is of concern to me. Where in the record, and what's the site for it, did you request a ruling by the district court in either or both of these cases that you're requesting from this court?
First, if I can just very quickly refer, I will answer that, but I want to refer the court to the repetitive nature of this issue. We did actually file in our appendix or in our response to one of Mr. Owens's motions to dismiss. We appended to our opposition the multiple cases that we have litigated in the lower courts on this issue to show this court the continuing nature of this particular issue. But secondly, to your honor's point, if you look in the pleadings, we specifically ask both in court and in the pleadings for the relief that we're seeking here, which is number one, we wanted a do-over because the grand jury return procedure at which that money bail order was set was constitutionally
flawed. So you're saying your written motion to the district court is
yes.
Where you made this specific request,
yes, ma'am,
that you're making to this court?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
It asked to vacate the underlying order so that we wouldn't bear the burden of showing why our client should be released and start from ground zero. And we specifically would ask, say what you're asking, what you mean by this money bail that you're requesting.
We understand that. You answered the question. Thank you.